fail here. Foster.
Good morning, Commissioner. My name is Reverend Rebecca, and I'm here today to make the talk in the new cloud on behalf of the Commission. This pre-filed season, I'm saying that it's been pre-read, and it's focused on the progress for our social society, and Mr. McIntosh and Mr. Clark to speak briefly to the Commission. Formally, the Commission was also pre-filed.
I don't have submissions. I don't have them. I have read the evidence. In my sense, I've read the evidence.
We have.
Which addresses the flexible nature of the standards. petition, what is why reports are critical of that flexible nature. However, the flexible nature of the code of practice acknowledges that there is more than one way to mitigate loss from fire, and that there is no one size fits all approach to that mitigation. The provision of 45,000 litres of water is a fair-based requirement for non-sprinkler dwellings on a non-particularly water supply. For other measures, such as sprinkler systems or access to open water supplies, such as ponds, can be factored in to reduce the volume of water required. In addition, the code of practice addresses much more than a simple volumetric supply of water. It addresses the accessibility of that water in terms of fire appliances and connections, and Mr. McIntosh will talk to you about what the code requires in that regard. And if it is considered that it is more appropriate to include reference to the code of practice as a whole, as opposed to certain strict volumetric thresholds, as if the volumetric threshold was set, this would result in a more rigid requirement than what the code of practice provides for. If the volumetric threshold is set at a month at 45,000 litres, developers may need rental consent because of the breach of the standard, and consent would be required even when the commission considered that other factors present, such as sprinklers, meant that a lower volume of water still complies with the code of practice. The cost of an unnecessarily high volume of water would also be imposed on the developer. The commission would need to be involved through that consent process to ensure that an acceptable outcome was achieved through that consent. If that threshold is set too low, development may occur in the absence of appropriate provision of water supply, which may result in unnecessary loss to property or life if a fire were to occur. A low threshold could also remove the ability for the commission to be involved in that process. Reference to the compliance with the code as a whole allows for this flexibility to be realised by the council and developers. It is not a case that the permitted activity standard results from uncertainty as to whether an activity is permitted or not. The requirement of compliance with the code of practice is clear. If the code is complied with, either by providing the 45,000 litres or an alternative amount approved by the New Zealand Fire Service, the activity will be permitted. If not complied with, consent will be required. It is sufficiently certain to be understandable and functional. The manner in which compliance with the code of practice is satisfied is either by meeting that volumetric requirement, which will be out in Table 2, or of the code, or by approval from the fire service for a different amount. This is set out in the code itself, and I've got the references here to the message. This is no different to other permitted activities where written approvals or petitions are required. Paragraph 33, it is submitted that there is no difficulty from a legal perspective of including the code of practice as sought within the plan. My third and final thing is around the memorandum of understanding. Section 42A report for the rural and gifting character zone chapters attached to the existing MOU is in place between the council and the commission. The existence of the MOU is directing the panel and the Speaker of Strategic Direction chapter hearing. The Commission submits that the existence of the MOU does not present the need to include reference to the code of practice in the plan or distract from the appropriateness to do so. And the Commission has a history of working with District Councils throughout the country, including Queensland Lakes District Council, to address concerns with firefighters' water supply. As part of that process, the MOUs are often entered into in order to practically address the absence of other available mechanisms. If that is so, whether issues not dealt with in district plans and whether there is no proposed marketing and plan review. Sometimes they include reference to the 20,000 feet concession as a pragmatic response for particular types of buildings in particular locations. The Commission is constantly learning about how different people interact with and implement the code of practice. And it's in light of these learnings and when opportunities arise that the Commission is now looking to adopt a more sophisticated approach that involves full compliance with the code of practice as a requirement of the district plan itself. monitoring its application as well, understood, transparent, and that a case specific flexibility that office has realised. The Commission expects that this approach will result in better outcomes than a blanket one size fits all volumetric limits. The Commission's preference, therefore, is for the plan to refer to compliance with the code of practice and not to other to a threshold or other parts of the code of practice in isolation.
Just any more discussion of the application of the code to limited activity status, and given that it would look at permitted activity, there is no applicant. The person just does it. Is the fire service satisfied that in those circumstances adequate compliance would occur?
But how are they
going to how is anyone going to know that that
being applied?
Yes.
Sort of looking being out of committed stance in that case that provides guidance to the users of the plan and the resources that is the requirement. In terms of what it actually requires.
But we'll take an example. It's a permitted activity in the plan to do 50 cubic metres of earthworks. If someone does 100 cubic metres and no one notices it, then that happens. That's the same with the omission of things. I'm just wondering whether a more realistic and practical place to achieve the fire service objectives would be to have in the rural zone where it's required to have a building platform that which requires a consent, that the requirements be imposed as part of the consent for the building platform, so it becomes consent notice, part of the consent notice provisions, and then it is clearly has to be complied with, and the council has alerted the landowner to it. I'm just trying to think of a practical solution. I understand what you're trying to do. That's the first part of it.
And I understand the difficulties of enforcing a permitted activity standard against a pragmatic approach. Obviously, the sooner the issues are addressed, the better for subdivision, the better in terms of making sure that supplies and assets are provided, because the further down the track you go, the harder it is and the more expensive it is to deal with that. I'm not sure if we've thought about that issue.
Well, I think the way in which the relief was crafted and my evidence is a standard in Table 2 that applies to all activities, not just permitted activities. So in the case of the consent to establish the building platform, the code of practice standard would apply in that case as well, so it would be captured. I think the risk of not having the code of right permitted activities would be that there's no at least attempt to ensure that those permitted activities have adequate firefighting rules to play. I think it's difficult to plan for someone inadvertently not complying with the district plan.
I don't think inadvertently is necessarily the case in many instances. The second question I have that both of you maybe want to answer is the code. As I read the submissions, there's a living code that alters. How can a district plan deal with that when it has to be certain? And if the code was to change, it would need to have a plan change to update the plan.
Maybe that's
the
current form that has been referred to, and if that were to change it, board replied that plan change just as any other document has incorporated into the plan by reference. What it means.
Good morning, Commissioners. Adequate firefighting water supplies are essential to fire services minimising fire damage to properties, particularly in rural areas, and to minimising fire spread and, in some cases, saving lives. Access to those water supplies is essential in terms of time taken for the fire service to get, or the term we use, to get to work, in other words, the time we arrive until we actually put water on the fire. Inadequate supporting infrastructure, including roading, access, and the water supplies themselves, exposes firefighters to unnecessary risk, which may require us to alter our tactics to protect firefighters' safety, and we have a safe person concept around that. So our tactics are determined when we arrive according to circumstances. Inadequate infrastructure therefore compromises the fire service's ability to discharge our statutory responsibilities. The New Zealand Fire Service Firefighting Water Supplies Code of Practice is the key document setting up the requirements for firefighting water supplies in New Zealand. The recognition of this code of practice and planning documents ensures that fire services have sufficient water resources and importantly access to those resources to extinguish the fire and to prevent its spread. From the code of practice specifically, the code of practice talks, in addition to water quantity, about access to water supplies in terms of road width, gradient, hard standing, that's the solidarity of the ground, height clearance such as trees and power lines, etc., and the visibility of the supply, in other words, signage. And specifically in relation to rural properties, in particular, it covers the distance between the tank and the property involved, the grading stability, the tank outlet capacity and the couplings, use of other surface supplies such as ponds and streams, dams, etc. And again, it refers to signage identifying that water supply to firefighters when they arrive. From the memorandum of understanding, the purpose of the MOU with QAC was to reduce the frequency of consent applications being placed before the fire service, which overwhelmed their very limited resources. So QAC staff currently utilise the MOU, but call on fire service expertise for advice with alternative supplies such as ponds. The MOU does cover the points above in relation to access. From the code of practice, and as already mentioned, it provides for 20,000 litres within a 30,000 litre tank for rural family dwellings only, and 7,000 litres when the dwelling is sprinkled. So I guess in summary, our water supplies are essential for us to be able to adequately perform our duties and to particularly prevent the spread of fire, which may be beyond the dwelling to into vegetation. And beyond.
Thanks, Mr. Speaker. Turning to paragraph 20 of your evidence, and at the end of the paragraph, urban fire districts. Is that just what they happen to be called?
Yes.
Rather than, like, you don't call them rural fire districts or something, or how does it work?
Well, no, we have designated urban fire districts. If you want to take Queenstown as an example, the Queenstown urban area is constituted as the Queenstown urban fire district, and outside of that, the rural fire district now belongs to the Otago Rural Fire Authority. In the time ahead though, 12 months out, with the amalgamation of all fire services into one fire emergency in New Zealand, these boundaries will likely disappear.
In the
code, the code of practice, if it, in the list that I just saw without looking at the detail of it, it doesn't include pressure. The water has to be supplied at a particular pressure. Is that a issue that you're concerned about? Or?
Yes, it is. In terms of how we operate, our soft hose, our soft feeder lines require at least a minimum of 100 kilopascals of pressure. But in the rural environment, we're relying on mainly on static water, which we use suction hose for some pressure. It depends on the amount of pressure available, so which means we use to connect into the water supply, basically. So in the rural environment, a tank, we specify that the tank has a coupling appropriate to allow fire service suction hose.
Right.
And we pack draft on the tank, and then there are distances involved, and what have you, that makes it critical for us to be able to do so. So in the urban environment, pressure off will supply generic ownership.
In paragraph 29, where you're referring to the water supply requirements, do they vary in the rural area depending on the size of buildings in that area? Here they have a 1,000 square metre building platform, and the plan currently refers to a 500 square metre dwelling as permitted, or you need consent about that. But does that building size, does that influence the requirements in terms of how much water and what have you need?
Yes, it does, and that total two, I think, because the total two talks about that.
So can you scratch through?
Well, you got table one?
Page 19.
Sorry, I've just got an abbreviated version here. Okay, so this festival starts with sprinkler structures, and then it talks about a water supply classification, a size of that, and then it comes down to, so it goes up from FW1 right through to FW7, and then in that table shows you the difference, square meterages of the largest fire cell in the building, and then in what particular water category applies to that. And then that takes us to the following table of table 2, which talks about the minimum amount of water supply required. Now the alternative to this is one means of calculating the amount of water supply. There is also provision in the code for a fire engineering calculation. So a fire engineer can submit a calculation to the fire service for approval, which might vary from the support supplies in here for a particular building. So the 3-2 means by which the amount of water required is arrived at.
In terms of the building size here in Queenstown District, from information we've received from council officers, most of them are under 500 square metres in area, in the area, but there might be a few that are potentially over that. In terms of could you explain the table to me? I'm trying to understand. Is there a big issue between how much the volume of water required for a smaller house under 500 compared to one over 500 square metres in floor area? So under 500 and 500 to 1,000 effectively.
It really depends on the extent of the fire, if we're right. I mean, it may not. I mean, if we can get to where, as I said before.
Sorry, I mean in terms of the FW5 NSW, what, 4, NSW 6, I think, up to 1,000, it might go to NSW 7. What's the difference in terms of the volume in those, in terms of what someone would need to provide on site in order to?
How usual
is it for someone to put in a sprinkler system in a house in a rural area in Queenstown?
They're not common. I mean, we encourage them, but they're not common.
Right. So most of the time, people fall within the non-sprinkler.
Yeah, correct.
The part for FW2, and then you go to that table there to work out the. Because it's called a family home, there's no size limit on the house relative to how much water you need to provide.
Is that 45,000 units, or is that for a collection of units, if you like? Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how the FW2 applies to him.
Yeah,
so
that's
the
question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure the answer to that question, John. Well, it does talk about large as fire cell. So why would he expect each unit to be a separate fire cell?
Clarification of it might be helpful.
It's got non-sprinkler structures category housing. It doesn't mention fire cell there. It just says includes single family dwellings, multi-use dwellings, but excludes multi-storey apartment blocks. The reason I ask the question is that some submitters are seeking that there be more than one dwelling permitted on a building platform in rural areas. So the obvious question is, if there are two or three, do you need two or three times the 45,000 cubic metres for the water? I'm sorry, 45,000 litres.
Without being certain, I would suggest you move down to the next category. We talked about the size of the fire cell, because those units would be separated, they'd be separate fire cell.
There's also an issue for a residential flat being part of a residential unit. Does that constitute two dwellings, therefore? And that may or may not be contained within each other, I don't think. Well, they don't need to be connected.
Clarification on,
but
just
do not get
those
neighbourhood
built
structures as opposed to
two
houses in a structure.
Mm. My gut feeling would be no, because that would be quite a normal housing environment situation in
Queensland. If they were in one building.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, very common.
Yeah.
So if they were all in one building, it would only be one.
Yes.
Well, if not, you took for a non-sprinkler.
In addition
to
that,
those of us from the Upper Tufa ask, wonder about that, given some of the subdivisions over there you might be familiar with.
They're certainly very aware now, they'll be made aware. Mm. There is a plan to get that clear.
I think it'd be helpful if we could come back with some clarification on, particularly on how that part of it works relative to the size. So it could be that it's already covered by the MOU that you have with council potentially, or you might want to talk to council officers and about whether they, how do they interpret that, just so that we can be certain that if this is a requirement and it's important, then just how it would be actually implemented.
But the simple size of it, so the single structure as well as multiple structures.
So when it says structure, does it, if you've got accessory buildings like a separate garage and implement shed, how does that work compared to the house, or is that already covered in?
It's covered in the draft.
Oh, okay. So have you had any examples, sir, of any issues where the either a shortage of water or incorrect connection things to water tanks in the district?
I can't give you any specifically, but okay. I do know that we've been, you know, working with the council for a number of years now, and so we're certainly minimising the number of circumstances where that can occur, because there's a lot of dwellings out there in the rural area that have a water supply available to us and that metals or conditions. So I guess if you went back beyond 10, 15 years, you'll find buildings that were pre-safer to standard. And yes, we do. It does affect our ability to be able to do our job, basically.
Turning to paragraph 35 of your evidence, could you explain to me what it says in the middle of the paragraph? This MOU provides for a 20,000 litre static water supply within a 30,000 litre tank. What does that mean?
Okay, my understanding for that is that a 30,000 litre water tank is a standard size tank that you can almost buy off the shelf.
Yes.
So the agreement with QLC was that we would accept a minimum of 20,000 litres, and QLC would want obviously a domestic water supply as well. Mm-hmm. So it's 20,000 for firefighting, 10,000 for domestic supply.
All right. So the water tanks made of plastic, polyethylene, so they have to be a certain distance away from the, it says they've got to be within 90 metres on this thing, but so they actually have to be no closer than...
It's not specified, and it's probably being missed, but we always require 6 or 7 metres of separation between the tank and the dweller. The alternative of that is to provide shielding, so we can, when we look at each case for council, assuming this is one of the more difficult cases, then we will recommend shielding. And we take advice from our fire engineers.
Yeah. So that's not in the code at the moment?
No, it's not.
Therefore, I think it would be difficult for us to address that within the scope of your submission. It's probably more to the two people on the left and right. Is it within the scope of the submission for us, or any way that we could address that, or is it really waiting on the standard to be fixed?
Not thought about, but we can come back to you on that when we come back with our application around the structure.
Okay. in terms of the standard itself, what's the date? What's the date on the IE? When was it last updated? Do you know, is additional work being done on that standard, and is that coming out anytime soon?
We had expected it to be reviewed by now, but it hasn't been. A review is pending, I believe. I can't put a date on.
I'm just trying to be proactive and think, well, if someone was going to amend it between now and thinking aloud here, by the time the decisions, whatever came out, that maybe a reference to a more newer version might be more.
I think that would be ideal. My understanding is that the code isn't in formal review, and it's probably one of those matters that has been part pending the Fire Service review and the review of the Fire Service Act. So I wouldn't anticipate a review standard within the life of your decision making.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It would be something that we would alert you to if that occurs.
But standard making takes a little bit of time.
Thank you.
Mr. Thank you, Mr. McIntosh. Is it becoming standard for the New Zealand Fire Service to recommend that code of practice is referenced under district plans or referred to?
Yes, we assist the Fire Service throughout New Zealand, and it is
increases the requirements to seek compliance with the code across the board. So this was coming as standard on a submission to plan reviews?
Yes.
And how many district plans are taking up that opportunity to reference the code tonight?
So recently, the Christchurch decisions thus far have all included a requirement to comply with the code throughout all zones and the subdivision. Most recent hearing last week, Ms. Burke, her annoying district plan, that plan had some parallels to here because it did have an interim solution like the Queenstown bus, which was 20,000 litre, broader suite of rules, similar to what's been proposed in the 42A report here. Through the course of the hearing dialogue with the council, it's been agreed with the authors of the 42A report that compliance with the code would be the way to achieve the outcome. So we're awaiting decisions, obviously. There's some older plans as well. We estimate that the code's embedded in some way in about 70% of the plans in the country. Not all of them are permitted activity standards. And in some cases, the plans have a stronger slant towards subdivision as opposed to land use, and in other plans there are land use rules but not subdivision rules. So the approach as plans go into review is simply to seek compliance with the code at what stage the plan development.
Okay. And just in relation to the chairman's questions on the legal submissions, is there a trigger in the Building Act that would allow Fire Service to get involved in that avenue? Or are they relying on
the Building Act deals with fire risk within the building, but it doesn't deal with the water getting to the building. So there's a little bit of a regulatory gap, if you know what I mean. So say for instance you're building a school, you put all the sprinklers in or whatever else is required by the Building Act, but the Building Act wouldn't deal with the, whether the water supply to the building was adequate to supply those sprinklers.
But that's covered by the local government acts and water supply.
Well, it wanted to articulate the area.
For a circulated area, it's only here. Yeah.
But
in the rural area, no.
No.
Okay, thank you. And just back to Mr. McIntosh, and someone else can answer the question. It seems like other than the provision of good vehicle access and visibility and all the things that make sense in a sort of rural residential development, the main way of meeting FW2 is to provide that 45,000 litres of water. as that comes in, say, 2,500 metre tanks, which I understand is the standard, do you have any idea of the overall cost of buying the tanks and installing them?
No, I do not.
Okay.
No, I do not. But in terms of providing two tanks, we just ask for connectivity between the two?
Yes.
Just related to that, are the tanks, when they put two tanks on someone's property, are the tanks connected horizontally, or was it in series, or in parallel, whichever the correct term is? Are they used, the two tanks usually connected together down the bottom somewhere?
Yes, yes, correct.
And is there a requirement?
At the base of the tank, yes.
Right.
Right, and it's funny, in a district like this where residential development in a rural area is generally something that's it's been sort of a sensitive issue, things like the provision of water tanks often requires that the tanks are buried and coloured in a certain way, which obviously counters your ability to actually be able to find them and see them. That leads us to the idea of making the provision of specific signs saying this is where the water is. Are there particular issues when there is water on the site and the fire service arrives at an emergency and they can't find the tanks because we've hidden them too well?
I can't quite. That's why we do ask for signs, so that we can identify the water.
You ask for
signs. And that's quite simple. The tanks we bury them. We can take water out of the top of the tanks. We can, use such a nice to do that. It doesn't have to be up to ground, it doesn't have to have a fire service cupping, but an alternative still.
Yes.
As long as we've got ready access to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. In a region where it's incredibly dry, it's good to hear that there's the 10,000 litres for residential use and the 20 for the firefighting. And then I was just thinking, in terms of the ponds, they will naturally dry up. Whose responsibility is it to ensure that there is the ongoing capacity for firefighting and safety to the individual residents?
Absolutely.
And you hope that when you turn up, it's all
good? Absolutely.
So particularly with regards to the ponds, there's no ongoing, 10-yearly check out of that.
Access to forms is the issue, so just as those are the tanks.
Right. So ensuring you can escape through fences.
Oh, and the ground's solid and hard, how standing it's up.
So I guess when it gets to that point, the firefighting plan is created in conjunction with the health code owners, a plan is created for those household owners in terms of ensuring that.
Not a specific plan, a generic plan that in terms of the way we approach those properties, but not documented plan for the properties.
No. But is it common that you've got to have a conversation with the landowner about putting in something that's sufficient or?
Certainly. Under the MOU, QLEC staff generally handle most of the issues, but where they seek advice, we do go and speak to landowners, we do inspect them, and we do provide advice and counsel.
Okay, so the process would be that they would understand the code of practice and then call on you if they get any additional requirements?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm trying to understand whether, given the size of dwellings here, particularly in a lot of the rural area, I'd say particularly in the Wakatipi Basin, where they seem to have large dwellings, is there any issue with the volume of water that they require under the standard, even if that's provided, that it causes an issue for your people when they turn up in terms of the volume doesn't
I'm not aware of the issues, but it does determine the tactics that we use to put fire in.
Alright, if you just want one final question, just a thought. So, in terms of the plan, it's not documented anywhere in relation to that land. I'm thinking in terms of that all things could be good and then the land gets sold. If the new owners don't understand it, so again, there's high responsibility for that remains with the owners of the property.
Yes. In relation to plans, though, if there's a specific risk out there that we become aware of, we will prepare a special plan for that property. But it's not in a general residential area, or, you know, it needs to be something that's quite special, or poses a risk to firefighters, or it poses a special risk that we need to have documentation. Accessible to us for. But so I'm not saying we don't have plans, we do for specific risks.
Yeah. But the plan for that property in terms of ensuring that there's the right amount of water and it's still risks what you own that, and so I was just thinking about in terms of passing on that knowledge and how
sure.
That might work.
True.
Thank you.
It's not your line of mind. If when you come back to us on the issue regarding the separation of one unit or two units and a residential unit and that kind of thing, if you came back to us and said, well, the code doesn't help or whatever, then if you could also come back to us about a way to address it so that, from your perspective, that it would actually work, so that the correct amount of water for each unit, regardless of the code or how the plan might work, so that it was provided anyway, that would be helpful. So,
thank you. And I have questions. More than
okay, well, I'll be quite brief. I just have two things to deal with, obviously, by the water supply from the planning perspective, but also the provision of community activities in the rural zone. So perhaps I'll go to the inclusion of the code of practice first to deal with that matter and then on to community activities. Firstly, I want to note that the importance of firefighting water supply is not specified by the Special Commission or the Section 42A report. In fact, the 42A report support, and I quote, the management of this issue because it is important. The difference really between the parties is the Council's reluctance to include the code of practice in the plan. And the issues raised in this regard are really around the necessity of standards to be included in all of the zones. And the content of any standard that may be in the plan or law of the plan. So in terms of necessity of zones, the 42A report has concluded that the water supply standard is not necessary where habitable buildings are not permitted. And this goes to the question that was asked before. I don't agree that if no activity is permitted, you don't need the water supply, the code of practice, because everything I think in build habitable buildings, for instance. This is because the general standards equally apply to activities that require consent. And I contemplated not having the standard here and had a look at the plan of how activities might proceed through a consent process. And without a standard that refers to firefighting water supply and unbuilt or standard building height again and other matters, there's no direction in the plan to indicate that firefighting water supply might be a relevant matter in the Section 104 consideration. And it's on that basis that I've concluded amongst a number of other matters listed in my evidence that the inclusion of a standard provides greater certainty and clarity for plan users and is consistent with the 42A report's conclusion in relation to the importance of the issue. If I turn now to what the content of a provision of the plan for firefighting supply might look like, the Section 42A report doesn't support the inclusion of reference to the code of practice, but seeks to embed the existing practice, which is to reference the specific volume of water. This approach is preferred in the 42A reports on the basis that the standard may change, and we've discussed that a little already this morning, that it's a direction outside of the plan and that the code of practice includes some discretion. The legal submissions address a number of these matters, and I also, in my evidence, I can see that it's quite common for plans to require compliance with New Zealand standards. And as I noted earlier, there are a number of plans throughout New Zealand that include this code of practice as a New Zealand standard and rules in the plan. Any number of standards used in plans may be reviewed over time. That noise standard, helicopter landings, there are a number of standards that are embedded in plans throughout the country, and these can be reviewed. And it would be preferable if the standards were fresh and new at the same time the district plan is fresh and new, but obviously we've discussed the circumstances that not being the case here, but I don't believe that situation precludes the inclusion of New Zealand standards in the district plan. I also, just in terms of this discretion, a rule with direct reference to the code of practice maximises the opportunity for plan users to deliver case-specific solutions to achieve the compliance with the code of practice rather than the unders and overs that were referred to earlier. In my evidence, I talk about situations that the rule currently proposed in the 42A report states 20,000 litres, whereas if someone were to choose to put sprinklers in their house, that would be an oversupply of water and would trigger an unnecessary resource consent, whereas if the rule said comply with the code, that complies with the code, there's no need for a consent. So there's sort of a, so that's a, an under, and that's an oversupply, and an undersupply might also arise where the fire risk is such that 20,000 litres wouldn't be appropriate. There are also situations where you can have small hamlet-type developments where dwellers may share a firefighting supply, and the code of practice would enable that, whereas a standard rule requiring volume would require every single one of those hamlet houses to have a single firefighting supply for that dwelling, and that's not necessarily a good and efficient outcome, in my opinion. We also talked briefly about the ponds and other alternate water supplies, and perhaps if I could just comment on that on the basis that I'm aware of some evidence, five sets of evidence. The Kapiti District Plan, where the witness for the five sets there expressed some caution and a need to be really certain that those types of standard, potential standard water supplies aren't drying out, and that there's some caretaker. The code enables the fire service to have a look at the viability of those alternate water supplies to provide the firefighting water supply. Similarly, this morning I was dealing with a situation, an application for resource consent here in Flash in Auckland, where the landowner is proposing to use their swimming pool as a firefighting water supply. And this is a pre-year of discussions, if you like, with the applicant, where there's a necessity for that pool to be full at all times. So it's something that the code of practice enables a consideration of those matters. I lost where I was going there. On the basis of all of those reasons, really, I guess it's my conclusion that the code of practice should be included as a general standard across all of chapters 21, 22, 23, and there are a number of reasons for that, including in relation to the proposed Otago RPS and chapter 3 policy. I'm happy to take questions on that or continue to community activities, whichever group is.
Well, we'll do what that one first. I'm just wondering from a planning point of view, whether there's some benefit in designing a rule where, because we've got permitted activities, where there can be a simple standard that can be chosen to be used, which might be the 45,000 litres, accepting that that might be too much in some cases, but according to the code, probably isn't never going to be too little for a single run, and have as an alternative a consent, which could be a controlled activity consent for compliance with the code. But the reason I raise it that way is that the general requirement for a fifth activity is there has to be certainty as to what you've achieved, how you achieve the standard, and the code contains quite a lot of discretion as to how you do that. And I'm not sure that unless you can point me to an environment court decision that says that the code is acceptable, I'm a bit concerned that it would be creating a committed activity standard which is not giving that certainty.
Just the last part of that question is a matter for legal, but in terms of the first part, we have, as part of the broader contract that I work on for Fire Service, prepared submissions in the past that have sought the 45,000 litres. The challenge is writing that contract to be standard in the simple way that you would prefer, I'm sure. The reason for that is you still need to describe the water volume, the tank specifications, the couplings, the location of that area. And it ends up becoming quite a cumbersome rule. And there are examples of Tasman District has a rule in their plan that seeks to prescribe components of the code practice as a rule, and it's big and it's cumbersome, and it can effectively lead to people seeking consent where in fact they will supply that would be adequate and would comply with the code through alternate means. So that is it. You can write a rule.
I don't think the rule necessarily cumbersome because the couplings and the tank dimensions and the location, etc., the distances, those could actually be referred to in the code. But it could be that you can find with those parts of it, just like the noise standard set a noise limit and says that you have to measure it in accordance with the noise standard without setting up all the means of measurement and testing. And then if you were to breach that, then you go to the next step.
So what you're suggesting is a committed activity shall provide 45,000 litres of water, and that water shall be provided in accordance with the code practice?
Something as simple as that. And then if you want an alternative means of providing, then use the other, you make a controlled activity to then seek the alternative. I'm just concerned that we end up with people saying they're using the alternatives. There's no way of the council treating that, and everyone is ending up in a much worse situation.
I understand the predicament, and I think we'd be more than happy to come back with that alternative, try at drafting an alternative approach that addresses your concerns.
Yeah, I think it's more an issue in the rural areas than the urban, because the urban is more important than anything.
That's right, yeah.
That would be useful if we could do that.
And is also, just to confirm from Pfizer's perspective, that the 45,000 litres is some justification or whatever for that, that would be
certainly
an appropriate
and
number
to deal with those long unit scenarios as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was my question on that part of your evidence.
In 5.15, you talk about the conflict, as I understand, between the MOU and the code of practice. And this is whether my one asked for 25,000, one asked for 45. If I got it, is there actually a conflict between them, and what is it? Is really what I'm.
I think in the Section 42A report, it was suggested that what's in the code and what's in the MOU is in conflict. Mr. McIntosh deals with this in his evidence by basically saying the MOU was a pragmatic solution to address what the council probably saw as fire service being serial submitted on Regal's consent application, and it was placing a lot of it was onerous for the council officers, for applicants, and for the fire service. So, following some discussion, and the circumstances were increased after for particular types of dwellings, it was agreed that the MOU would resolve and decrease the amount of submissions and resources needed until such time as it was used. So, there's no conflict, it was just in those circumstances, it was agreed that the 20,000 litres would achieve compliance with the code. Pragmatic solution, I think, is the term you use in your evidence.
And alternatively, if a particular consents got a fine tuning, had a fine tuning calculation problem, then potentially that could be around that figure anyway. So, that's
the next question is more related to the provision of the tanks and that. So are the tanks considered, do you need a building permit for the tanks on a site?
I don't believe so. I've never been asked that question before. I don't know the answer.
Sorry, the question again.
So, do you need a building consent for a tank or tanks?
No, if it's on the ground and it's not, it's exempt from the Building Act as long as the tank is sitting on the ground or partially buried. The tank's on a support structure, so it's a certain size that wouldn't need
to be. Some of the exclusions has got a limitation on the tank size of maybe 35,000 litres.
No, I don't think it does.
And then, if the two tanks are connected together, does that push them over the 35,000?
Probably not in terms of a building consent, but if you ask me the same question, which you might be doing in terms of a resource consent, and the district can have what that tends to the building. The council do have a practice note around water tanks, because the ODP definition of building is anything bigger than 5 metres squared or 2 metres in height, but there is a practice note that if it's in the building platform, it's generally accepted that it's okay. But two tanks side by side, probably concerned with two separate elements, because there'd be a slight separation between them, especially if there's a pipe connecting them. That's it.
I was probably hoping for some more certainty, that was all, in terms of it, in case it, for those issues, and how does the, if the tank's within the building platform, and that, and what else constitutes all part of related things about how the 500 square metre limit on it, so are the tanks included? That's part of the reason.
Short answer is no, not normally.
We confirm whether it's, I think it's in the exclusions, maybe under 9 of the Building Act, but if the tanks are connected together and that, any issues around that, that would then trigger on for something else. Yep, that would be helpful. Thank you. Paragraph 522. the particulars of this rule, this is going to be a new rule that would be added in, is that?
That's what
I'm
talking about.
The rest of my questions just relate to the community activity facility. One, thank you.
Okay. No questions in the legislation.
Okay, very quickly. The Commission's further submission supports the primary submission of the Ministry of Education seeking objectives, policies and roles to provide for community activities in the rural zone. Fire stations fall within the definition of community activities and hence the Commission's interest. The Section 42A report concludes that non-farming activities should be contemplated on a case-by-case basis. In my evidence, I've noted that case-by-case assessment is achieved in the rural zone through a non-complying activity status for community activities. This means that a fire station would be subject to the Section 104D statutory test. The non-complying activity status differs to the approach taken to a number of other non-farming activities, such as visitor accommodation, some commercial and rural industrial activities in the rural zone. In my evidence, I express the opinion that given the non-complying activity status and the absence of policy direction in Chapter 21, that the non-complying activity status goes beyond perhaps the case-by-case assessment intended by the 42A report, and in fact could be preventative in some circumstances. I therefore support the inclusion of a suite of provisions that appropriately provides for emergency service facilities or community activities in order to enable the Commission's objectives to better implement the community activities objective of Chapter 3, including the associated policies, and also to implement the new objective sought by the Commission in Chapter 3, if in fact the panel will provide to accept that relief. I also note that such relief would be quite consistent and with the strong policy direction around lifeline utilities and emergency services in the proposed regional policy statement. And in my opinion, including at least some contemplation on emergency service facilities and certainly at least a subset of community activities would better achieve the purpose of the Act by enabling people in communities to provide their health, safety and well-being.
I take it from that last sentence that you are not suggesting that community, the broad category of community activities, just be willy-nilly allowed for even as a discretionary activity in the rural zone, but rather you're focused upon emergency.
Yes, I am. My evidence is necessarily focused on what that means in the context of emergency service facilities. That, the way I framed that last sentence was an acknowledgement that the broader category of community activities is larger and more broad, and certainly of the broader type of activities. That said, the relief sought by the Ministry relates to community activities. And in my opinion, it is appropriate to contemplate community activities in a rural zone through appropriate provision.
The obvious question that you probably won't be able to answer is, where does the fire service anticipate that it would need to put facilities within the rural zone in this district?
You heard evidence from Mr. McIntosh in the Chapter 3 hearing that there are no immediate plans for fire stations to be located in rural zones. That said, the plan has a substantial life and the fire service is being amalgamated and reviewed with new legislation. So this is why, I guess, by evidence to say you should consider how community services are addressed in the rural zone, but there's certainly fire service doesn't have sufficient seeking massive amendments to build form standards, particularly provide the height of a hose dry tower or anything, for instance.
Well, look, the reason I ask the question now is because while something like 96 or 97% of the district, or maybe even more, is zoned rural, in reality, there's only 4 or 5% of the district that's practically going to be suitable for those sort of activities. And other than Makarora, they're all close to existing urban areas. And I'm just wondering whether the extent of the necessity, given the nature of this district, and we're not talking something like Manawatu District, where there's a large area of rural with houses, the residential things that the fire service would need to attend to in this district are quite concentrated around the urban areas, both in the Upper Cooper and in the North City.
I think you're right to ask that question, and certainly in my evidence I've acknowledged this is back to previous verbal evidence to you in that regard. And I guess my answer is similar to my answer to your previous question, which is the fire service and the approach to emergency services is significantly altering such that the responsibilities the fire service may have in the future could include, and correct me if I'm wrong, some of the Department of Conservation firefighting responsibility and the Rural Fire Authority being combined with it. So there could, I'm not saying it's likely that fire service will need to locate in a rural zone in this district. I'm saying the plan should not foreclose the opportunity to do so.
I'm trying to understand whether you, is it necessary that it would fall under the definition of community facility or community activity, or would it be potentially better to have the provision made in regard to emergency services?
I think there's some merit in splitting emergency services from a broader range of community activities. I don't think it's necessary, but there is a merit in, and in the supplementary legal submissions to Chapter 3, in the last hearing you asked me about whether perhaps emergency services fell within the regionally significant infrastructure, and I'm not sure that's correct either. You could take some direction from the approach in the proposed RPS that does talk about emergency services and often lifeline users using emergency services in the same mouthful, if you like.
You said that a decision maker could rely on the objectives and policies within the rural zone because there aren't any here in regard to this. Because would they be able to rely on the objectives and policies that might be in chapters 3, 4, 6 in that strategic direction?
Yes, they could.
Would that be sufficient in your view for a decision maker considering that relative to where that sits within the plan when you've got something not mentioned in 21 but you do in the rural but you do up in 3?
It's a difficult question to answer, and it would depend on the extent of directiveness, I think, of the policies in particular Chapter 21, if they were used really strong terminology about the outcomes sought in the context of the rural zone, for instance, if you're insured and avoid the ability to rely on perhaps more general policy elsewhere in the plan, maybe more limited.
than achieving a balance across the plan. I don't think it's predicted.
And finally, just in terms of the submission that relates to the rural zone, it doesn't relate to the rural lifestyle and rural residential zones in 22 or perhaps the valley in 23.
No, look, the issue here is we're dealing with a further submission. So anything beyond the rural zone would be
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's why I haven't forgotten that thing.
I'm Rachel Brown, Susan Farmer from Hawea Flat. I've come a long way to speak this morning, so I hope you're not too hungry and ready for lunch. And bear with me, I missed the flip to come and talk to you in Hawea, but I just feel so strongly about this topic that I made an effort to come over this morning. And I never thought I'd do this, to speak for the humble pine tree. Just as a background, thank you so much for listening to the rural chapter. I think it's a very important chapter, particularly for us in Hawea. I worked on a community forum early on when we were looking into the district plan, and there was a lot of effort, particularly from Hawea, to really emphasise the importance of farming and the whole rural not just landscape, but functionality of our rural land as part of our district. And I found a very interesting comment from the Queenstown working group to us was, oh, we don't have any farming anymore, it's debased and it's irrelevant. And to me, that's a real big point of difference. It's a background to what I've come here to talk about, is that I really applaud the proposed district plan. I think the operative district plan was a lot about just painting a beautiful landscape for our tourists, and tourism was seen as the only economic driver. I think we've made a big step forward in our proposed district plan to recognise beyond tourism, to recognise farming, and something a bit more sustainable than just tourism. And the function of farming isn't just to graze the landscape to look good for the tourists, it is actually the functionality to that. And I think as a council we need to be going further than that and encourage actually an intensification of farming to provide some of our own food and products, so that we're not just living here looking pretty for the tourists, but actually producing nothing for ourselves. So in particular, I want to talk to chapter 34, wild and exotic trees. I find it very interesting in the purpose that talk about the values, the way the district value relies, the district values and relies on its distinctive landscapes, its open spaces and its rural productive land. And yes, it is a lot about balancing those three. I find it very interesting that it talks about the fact that we manage our existing wildland trees through the non-statutory document, the Waikatipu Wildland Conifer Strategy. And I fear that the whole district is being held to ransom by the Waikatipu Wildland Conifer Strategy, which I believe is maybe very pertinent to this area, but not necessarily to our whole district. I applaud Craig Barr for his summary of evidence to this panel in Hawea, where he actually took on board the fact that pine trees do actually provide some economic what was the actual wording you had? That, yeah, that to recognise potential positive uses and benefits associated with, in particular, Craig C. Radiata Pine, and he actually suggested or recommended that at least Radiata Pine could actually be planted under some kind of resource consent process, which is actually what I submitted on, is making it some kind of controlled activity rather than prohibited activity. But now I'm thinking we could even go a step further. I really commend the Federated Farmers submission and their further evidence to you, number 600, that although they appreciate the significant cost associated with the control of pines, more weight needs to be given to the economic benefits derived from the planting of some species of wildlings in the rural zone. I'd like to contest that in particular, like where I live in Hawea, where it is a real farming district, but it is really quite different from over here, where the kind of wildlife group was established. I find it ironic that these pines, these conifers you see here, are actually planted for their amenity value. But planted big because it was considered the iconic landscape at the time, the Alpine Resort Book. And they were planted for their amenity value. So there is something, and it's just to show the subjectivity of amenity and landscape and iconic landscape. This became the iconic landscape of Queenstown. This is why there was so much resistance to clearing those trees when it was first pointed out that they were causing problems by spreading out back into the farmland. There was resistance because this was the iconic landscape. Now we have a very, very active, and I do take my hat off to the of the Wakatipu Wild and Conifer Control Group. I take my hat off to them. They are passionate. They are doing a lot of good work because there is an acute problem here. They declared a war on wildlings because there is a real problem here. I go back to Ryder and Halbury, I look around and we don't need to declare a war on wildlings. They're actually being managed quite well. I don't know if when you were over in Halbury, whether you noticed Brayton pines out of control. And yet, they got planted in probably the same era as these, but they got planted to function. And they are performing a really important function over there. They are windbreaks. I don't believe that we could have been successful in farming in our district without conifer windbreaks. They are also being harvested for firewood, and they also provide some sort of, they could provide more forestry, and that's why people invest in forestries and forestry blocks. And a lot of the argument that the Conifer Control Group put is that council is spending so much money on control. On one hand, you can't be planting trees on the other. I don't believe that $1 of that control has been spent in the Hawea and the Aotearoa district. And so we can't be held to ransom for that money. It's because I believe that conifers over there are actually being kept under control. Yeah, there's a few areas, there's a few conifers creeping up Mount Maud, there's a few conifers creeping out the back of Mount Grand, but we can manage those, and they are being managed, and ORC is coming down heavy on some of the landowners, and we can manage those. I really believe that they can be managed. The conifer control group goes further than saying we should ban all trees. They say that council, as a community leader, should actually be removing all pine trees, all council land, removing all those trees over there, and should encourage landowners to do the same. I'm sorry, but that would be, I couldn't even keep my animals if I had to remove my pine trees tomorrow. That would be cruelty to animals if we had to remove all the pine trees. So where are we going with this policy? Like, I'd like to see if we're going to, if we really are controlling our lot of trees, or we're, what's going to actually happen? What is our plan with the trees that exist? The ones that are performing a function. I've seen many, many blocks of trees. What would happen if we had to chop them down next week? They'd probably actually be taken over by all sorts of other briar, broom. A lot of them are on quite wild, desolate places. There needs to be a succession plan. And I don't believe we've actually got that in place yet. I've yet to see a mature shelter belt consisting of another species, the Rahawia, because pine trees grow so fast. I've seen some young 5-year-old cypress trees, but they haven't been, there's no real test to know that that is actually going to be successful yet. So we can't ask the farmers to chop down their windbreaks until we know that something else can actually replace that. So maybe we need some trials. You know, that they use because they do grow so vociferously. You know, they're good as in they're bad, which is so true for so many things. So I think we need to do some work on this if we really do want to manage the situation. We need to really acknowledge the function of these trees and embrace that and manage them properly. So I really do encourage you not to be taken over by the, basically not held to ransom by the very people who it's become very emotional. It's become very emotional. We talk about iconic landscapes, which is quite a remarkable landscape. The image on the website of the Wakatuku Wildlife Control Group features an 1875 portrait of Queenstown to show how much pines have taken over. Yeah, that's a remarkable landscape. It's remarkably barren. There is nothing there. And that really is what we aspire to. Open landscapes. There's the remarkable landscape. That's remarkable. That is heavily modified. What is our iconic landscape? What is our natural landscape? It's an interesting one, isn't it? Outstanding natural landscape is an interesting term in itself. Outstanding, I don't have any problem with, but natural, I think, can become really quite subjective, and I just don't want to be held to ransom by what is becoming quite an emotional and fanatic sort of topic, you know, whether you actually like the look of pine trees or not. That's what it comes down to. What I do is I encourage you to take on Craig's evidence of acknowledging that there is a place for some trees, in particular radiata pines. Perhaps you could go as far as actually having a permitted activity with some very specific rules, because I think this plan is all about making things not too hard, not too many consents, not too expensive, because part of the attraction with planting pine trees is they're quite cheap. And definitely it should be a control of human activity in the right place, because I believe that we can still avoid the unwanted spread of pines by good land management, not by just a straight up prohibition. So that's really what I wanted to come and speak to you.
The trees that you have on your property, they're pine radiata?
The younger ones are. The older ones at the front that planted a long time, there's definitely some pine in ponderosa. Yeah.
And for what specifically do you use those for, your mission and your animals?
Yeah, that's social shelter. They shelter our house and they shelter our animals. And my neighbour behind, she actually specifically chose the section that most shelter by the pines, and everything is growing so much better. And another good example, she's a retired botanist. She planted pine trees and planted and established her native amongst them. 15 years later, chopped down the pine trees. And her native block is so much better established than any of ours. And that would be a permitted activity, what she did, if we accept the proposed district plan and the ban on planting the pine trees. You couldn't even use them as a nursery crop. And so I was amazed how effective that use of pine trees was. But yeah, our pine trees are big windbreaks. They were only planted 20 years ago, and they're incredibly effective windbreaks, and they don't spread because it's grazed all around. The only place it spreads is into a little driveway, which isn't grazed, and the seedlings there which I use to replenish my firewood block, and also the Christmas trees. So I believe, you know, we need to be able to plant firewood. If we can be a district that has to import all its firewood because we don't grow trees, then yet how many houses a day are being built with a log burner? I don't quite see how that's going to work.
So you are suggesting that there are different rules. Are you supporting that there is a need for the prohibition of those species in the Wakatipu, but you would support different rules for the Apatika, or?
I'm not convinced we need prohibition. Like, I think it's a reaction to a very acute situation over here, and I'm not totally sure how to manage it. Like, obviously, we've got a massive box here that's seeding the problem. And so, I mean, that's going to be a drop in the bucket, prohibiting planting and new stuff. And what is actually the plan for these blocks? And we're looking at the economic resource of conifers, what's the plan for the skyline nationwide tracks, the Bulloma? You know, there's a huge economic resource in the forest. What's going to happen when the Queenstown Lakes District Council maybe considers buying Sticky Forest, a huge recreational resource in the Upper Clutha, but we're not allowed to do it because the council can't own pine trees?
So following on from that, what other benefits, can you think of other benefits that those forests provide, the mountain biking ones?
Yes, it's a recreational shade. I bike through a little patch of pine trees on the Haru River track. Regularly, people are sheltering under there, having a nice little picnic in the shade. It's like, what happens when we have to chop all those down? The only thing that will grow there at the moment would be rampant weeds. Unless you're, you know, you can have access to native green vegetation, but it does take a while. It takes a lot of money. There's only so much you can do. So there's a lot of shade and shelter, and often really pine trees grow very little. Nothing else will grow.
So it sounds as if you've read the 42A report by Richard Spark. There's a list in there of species that could be used as alternatives. Are you aware of that list?
I haven't actually. No, I haven't seen that list.
So for those
uses,
for those uses that you're saying, there's the pine failures, and some of these other now quite prohibited species. Are there other species that you would suggest that people would use instead?
Well, I haven't seen, like, I've seen some trials with some young ones, but I haven't actually seen anything that's looked fruity. I think it's really early days in suggesting there's alternative species because there aren't any living proof of them yet. Like, I've seen Leyland cypress, 5 years old, a shell spout. That's the only shell spout I've seen in our district of something other than. And pines, and it's a 5 years old and it's a thing, it's looking good so far, but it's a long way to go until it flips the shelter.
Thank you, Dwayne.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. So you're obviously familiar with the list of prohibited species that are in the nation of
Yes.
So just generally speaking, do you think that that's an appropriate list?
Really, Scott? Where do you start? I actually have a problem with prohibition and genocide. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to say that. A problem because I don't know where do you start, where do you stop. I mean, a lot of it comes down to, you know, personally what you like and what you don't like. I can never quite understand what's wrong with beautiful hawthorn hedges around Tahawea. I'm downwind from them and they never actually settle. I actually like a hawthorn hedge and I've had a lot of difficulty establishing one because where they grow up, they just get grazed out when they're trying to establish. And I use the area blocks. I've had native caribou spending the winter in that grand bush and eating hawthorn berries. we wouldn't be here without the hawthorn. So I've a little bit of a problem with saying those are bad plants and these are good plants. Because we live in a human modified environment, I don't think anything will happen. So, yeah, but anything means to go out of control. And I do understand why things like plants can alter. They've been on the bad list for a long time because they do seem to be particularly spreadable. And they're not particularly useful because they fall all over the place and stuff. And I mean, pulling contortion on the central plateau probably 40 years ago, and raised money for the Cranston Club. It's been a issue for a long time. But, you know, like I know, as soon as people see that list, I'm not like, just add this, you know, and we could add all our weeds.
So your position is that we shouldn't really be banning the planting of any species?
Yeah, I think it's more about management. It's a hard thing as humans, isn't it? Like, where do you draw the line and leaving people to managers or actually, giving them rules? Because in the right place, even like the wildland conifer, the conifer control people say, the right tree in the right place is fine. And that's really exactly what it is. The right tree in the right place is fine. But then they go on to talk about, a list of specimen trees. I'm not talking specimen trees, I'm talking functional trees. So it's not all about looking good, it's actually about functioning in our community.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
We're doing 5 past 2.